Hi, folks. Welcome to the Wildlife for You podcast. I'm Stephanie Payne.
And I'm Daryl
And we talk about wildlife and conservation in ways that make sense, all backed by science facts.
Yes, and tonight we're going to talk about wildlife critters that have pretty much really figured out how to coexist with humans. So we're going to be talking about wildlife that has taken up that urban lifestyle. You know, they got the pad on 42nd Street, they got their leisure suit. No, we're not talking about things that live in our house. So we don't mean things like house mice or rats. We mean like legit wildlife.
Agreed. So, while lots of folks take treks into nature or live in very rural areas where wildlife is common, more people live in cities and more urban areas. While most big cities may not see a lot of wildlife in downtown, there is a solid chance that wildlife is still very near, especially in those urban areas just outside of the city. But in addition to species that have perfected this, we want to talk about the science behind how they did it.
So where do you want to start when we're talking about this stuff?
Good question. I know you said we weren't going to discuss those common, synanthropic species that wear leisure suits and live in the house, but do you want to at least call them out?
But let me first start by defining what we mean by psyanthropic. You know, I'm not one of those big nerdy word guys, so.
Okay, sure.
All right. So here's what we're talking about, folks. Psyanthropic species have literally been hanging out with humans for so long that they're literally adapted to cohabitation with people. Yet they're still considered wild animals. So some have gone so far as to be incapable of living without humans. Lice, for example, and just so you know, Stephanie and I have talked about this at length, but there are such thing as human lice. They're probably the easiest example since they need humans to survive.
And now everyone's head itches. Thanks, Dee. So, why don't you just give them a list of psyanthropes we aren't going to focus on?
Okay, because we do want to focus on the wildlife species that are more wild than anything. Because a lot of people, when you think of these species that are really in and around humans, you're thinking of old world rats, you're thinking of rock doves, which are also known as pigeons, or you're thinking of like feral cats and dogs. Those are the common species people think about, like in the urban, really urban city-like environment.
Yeah. And like Daryl said, these examples and the psyanthropes we'll talk about are technically still wildlife, but they really almost fall somewhere else. They have cousins still living in the wild, but these individuals who live in the burbs are not exactly wild anymore. Then again, they aren't exactly domestic just because they live around people. The cool thing about psyanthropes is that we can study them to help understand how these behavioral adaptations may be factors in natural selection. So maybe that's actually where we should sort of start.
Okay. So what Steph is trying to say is wildlife who don't live in the wild have to change a lot more than just being able to ignore us or avoid people and people-related hazards.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't clear on that.
Not particularly.
Noted. I feel like you spent half of your time saying to say what Steph just said.
Yeah. Well, you are the brilliant one, and I gotta hear what you say and then put it in my own words just to understand what the heck you're talking about.
Right. So yeah, sure, there's things like, avoiding people or pets or cars, but there's also things like, well, mating. How do these urban critters, vocalization is huge in mating. So how do they vocalize to each other with all that other noise that they're competing with?
Like shock gobbles.
Like what?
Shock gobbles. Now, I know you've heard them before, Steph, but I want to explain a little bit of what shock gobbles are to our listeners. Now, you've always had a number of turkeys hanging around by your house. You live in the country, beautiful turkey country. When we're talking about these turkeys, they're sometimes the funniest creatures in the world because during the early spring when they're mating, the male turkeys, otherwise known as toms or gobblers, they will gobble at female turkeys or oftentimes they'll gobble at those rival tom turkeys, those other male turkeys. So just so everyone knows what we're talking about, Steph, you want to demonstrate what a gobble sounds like?
No, not happening.
Fine. You ever hear the that is what a turkey gobble sounds like. Now, many people may have heard them in the wild or may not have, but it's just a really, really cool call. The thing that I think is so funny is because these male turkeys, they'll be out there looking for the girl or looking for that rival out there, and they're wanting to gobble, and they'll hear a noise, and it's a man-made noise, and they think it's one of their rivals, and they'll immediately respond. And that's what we call a shock gobble. You make a loud noise, and that male turkey is going to respond to you. Now, I've heard turkeys gobble. Get a load of this. They've gobbled at train horns. You know those jack brakes on semis that when they're coming down a hill?
Yeah.
I swear I'm not making this up. I've had a big squeaky gate on the side of the house that when I would push it out, it'd make a big squeaky noise, and I would have a turkey gobble at that. And so it's crazy the amount of man-made noises that turkeys will gobble at. And it's an interesting question whether or not all this man-made commotion is affecting some of these animals out there.
Yeah. And that is an example of what we're talking about. You know, does that human environment, those extracurricular activities, those noises, you know, do they actually influence the behavior of the animal?
Yeah, and it's a good question. And you are in luck tonight because since you suggested this topic, I did quite a bit of Googling to dig up some information, some sound science for our podcast.
And just to be clear, folks, Daryl is not simply referring to the standard old Google search engine that everyone has not only come to know and perhaps love, but they've also obviously thrown complete blind faith into. So remember, again, Google is simply a search engine that returns information on a topic. It is not vetted as far as the quality of that information. So unfortunately, it's oftentimes full of junk, since absolutely everyone and their brother or sister, or even that cousin that nobody likes to talk about, they can submit information to the interwebs. So what Daryl and I often use as our starting point is Google Scholar. So you know, it's a search engine that Google has built, and it actually searches for articles that have been published in journals. I won't go on a tangent that all journals are not created equal, but it does at least get us one step closer to science. So once you find an article, if it's a good peer-reviewed science article that provides you with some information, the cool thing is the literature cited at the literature cited section of the paper, it can usually then lead you to many more studies on that very same or at least related topics.
That was such an excellent point. I'm so very glad you brought that up. Believe it or not, Steph, it actually scares me. How many people actually think Google is like this informational juggernaut? And well, it is an informational juggernaut, but it's also an informational bad informational juggernaut because it doesn't always return good information. It can at times, but it's literally a roll of the dice whether the information you get back from Google is any good, meaning whether or not it's based on science or it's simply someone's opinion. And so oftentimes people try to imply their opinion as fact, and that always gets us in bad predicaments. Anyway, my initial search on Google Scholar for tonight's topic, I ran across a very useful article. It was actually part of the proceedings from the 4th International Urban Wildlife Symposium. And what it was more or less a summary by this gentleman who's got a funky first name. It's like Marciage, but his last name is Luniak. And what he did is he summarized some of the behavioral changes in animals that have more or less adapted to that urban environment.
Yep. And that was a great summary. And in it, they mentioned this fancy word called synurbization, which denotes the adjustment of wild animal populations to the specific conditions of urban environment. So in other words, it's how animals adapt to living close to humans in their urban environments. Here, I'll give you an example of some of the adaptations that have been observed. A higher density of population connected with the reduction of individual territories, pair and family, reduced migratory behavior, prolonged breeding season, and other changes in breeding ecology, prolonged and changed, sometimes adverse, circadian activity, increased longevity but worse health parameters, changes in diet and foraging behavior, increased intraspecific aggression, tameness towards man, and various adaptations to human behavior.
You were reading that, weren't you? You had to jot that down because it was really good observations that came out of that paper. And I didn't want to interrupt you there because I knew you were quoting some of those findings. But I'd like for you to clarify at least two of the things you just said.
Sure. Which two?
Tell our listeners out there what you mean by changed circadian activity. And then after you do that, can you please define intraspecific aggression?
Sure. So circadian activity pretty much refers to how one's body reacts to changes in light, primarily sunlight and day length. So as an example, the amount of light is usually the trigger for most breeding seasons, or I should say the time in which animals will mate.
Can I add a little tidbit of why that is?
Because my track record for stopping you is so stellar.
Well, no, but the reason animals have this circadian rhythm is when you look at timing things throughout the year, you cannot depend on other environmental factors. For example, you cannot let your breeding season be solely dependent on weather, like, for example, the onset of cold weather. Because if that was the trigger for you to breed or do any other biological function, your whole rhythm could be thrown out of whack if there is a freak cold spell. And so if you look at things that can be highly variable from one day or one month to the next, you have things like temperature, barometric pressure, all of those things can change and you could have freak events happen. And you don't want that freak event to trigger something prematurely. The one thing that happens, what is today's date? Today is May 27th.
Yeah, that'll work.
Okay, so May 27th. What is the one constant that is going to happen on May 27th this year, next year, 200 years from now, 200 years ago, 1,000 years from now? May 27th, there will be one constant, and that is?
Sunlight.
Sunlight. And so sunlight, also known as photoperiod, is generally what triggers responses in animals, some behavioral response, whether or not it's mating season or hyperphagia or something like that. Most of it's based on photoperiod.
Yep. So in an urban environment, an animal's circadian or body rhythm can be thrown off, especially if there is an inordinate amount of light, such as street lights or stadium lights. And as far as the intraspecific aggression goes, that simply means that they tend to fight more within their own kind. You know, if it was conspecific, it would mean fighting other species. So since this is intraspecific, it means that, you know, they're having fights with others of their own species.
See, now that's really interesting. And it makes me wonder why living in an urban environment would cause animals to fight more amongst themselves.
Well, if you read the study more thoroughly, Doof, it explained all of that. Besides, I think humans have perfected this trait. But anyhow, because urban environments can often provide all of the resources the animal needs, they tend to have much smaller home ranges. So that leads to an increased density of animals overall and a higher probability of them running into each other and then competing for resources. So, you know, simply put, more animals in a smaller area.
Okay. I get it. Kind of like where I'm more likely to fight with, say, my brother if he's living in the same county as me or if he's in the same room as me. Obviously, the closer you are to someone else, the more likely you are to get in a fight with him.
Exactly. So for you two, I'd actually go so far as to say in the same state even.
Funny there. Now, I will say in this paper that we both have looked at, They did talk quite a bit about a few of the bird species, namely blackbirds, and how well blackbirds have adapted to urban life. Now, you know as well as I that I'm not the greatest birder in the world, or heck, the even greatest birder in the same room, but I do have some bird species I'm quite fond of, one of which is a prime example of an urban-loving or urban-benefiting species. Now, just so you know, if you notice throughout our discussion so far, other than me trying to define it for everyone, I'm trying not to use that word cyanthrope, simply because it's not a word that we typically use, and me and you were like wildlife nerds. So I don't want to confuse everyone, but I think we're going to have to throw it out here a bunch coming up. So anyway, back to the discussion. You know how I love those predator type species? One of my favorite bird species is actually the peregrine falcon.
Oh, the perfect cyanthrope.
See, you are that wildlife nerd that I just mentioned.
Yeah, I'm serious. Peregrine falcons are such a great example of a cyanthropic species. You know, they've adapted so much to urban living that some of the highest densities of peregrines are now found in giant urban centers such as, you know, New York and Berlin. But you think about it, where do peregrines love to nest?
Well, believe it or not, I actually studied and worked with peregrines when I was out in New Mexico, but where they prefer to nest is like way high up in the steepest of those cliff faces.
Exactly. And skyscrapers fit that description to a T. So now tell me, what do peregrines love to eat?
Pretty much the same thing I do. They love to eat those big, chunky, big-breasted birds that are super slow that they can they can kind of pummel from above.
I don't even know if I want to respond to you right now, but yes, exactly.
I was thinking chicken, but I imagine peregrines kind of prefer like pigeons and other birds like that.
So where do we see huge flocks of slow flying, relatively chunky or rotund pigeons?
Big breasted pigeons. That's pretty easy. You find them in that city environment. And it's like, as soon as you think about it, it's like, holy cow, we just created a peregrine paradise with our cityscapes.
And that's why some animals are doing so much better around humans. You know, we often create an unnatural habitat that is actually very suited or very similar to their natural habitat.
Okay, quick question for you here. Can you think of or talk about an animal other than a bird that has benefited from the urban environment?
Oh, dude, I can think of a bunch of mammal species. Just think of your backyard wildlife, small mammals like squirrels, rabbits, foxes, raccoons, even my beloved woodchucks are highly adapted at living in or around an urban setting. You know, usually it's because they have a high tolerance for humans, but it's also because we often provide them with an inordinate amount of food resources. You know, think of all those ornamental bushes and, you know, the small gardens that rabbits and other critters just love to forage in. You know, they in turn attract some of those meso predators like foxes and coyotes.
I'm going to go on a quick tangent because you mentioned your beloved woodchucks, and I have to laugh because when I was working in New Mexico on a forest, on a national forest out there, one of the critters we were so concerned about was this little prairie dog, the Gunnison's prairie dog. And so they're a sensitive species. Like, we're worried that their species were declining. And finding them on the forest was often quite difficult. There's a couple of small spots where we could find these little prairie dogs. And then you drive down the highway in the city of Santa Fe, and there's a prairie dog, a Gunnison's prairie dog town in between the median on some of the busiest highways. And it's like, we're so worried about these critters up in the forest, and they're living in like the junkiest man-made urban environment. So that totally reminded me of the Gunnison's prairie dog when you mentioned your woodchucks there. So yep. Anyway, the way you just described it with those little critters that live around us, whether or not they're squirrels or prairie dogs or groundhogs or rabbits, because we have those animals in that area, we attract those meso predators. But I'm thinking I'm I'm catching you here in a bind.
Come again?
The second time around, I believe you mentioned coyotes, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm not buying this idea that coyotes are a cyanthrope. In other words, coyotes pretty much live everywhere, and so we don't typically think of them as benefiting from being around humans, or at least needing to be around humans to survive.
I would say that's a fair assumption.
But here's the thing, Steph. There are absolute cases where coyotes are thriving in an urban environment. So nowadays, you look at places like Chicago and New York City, they have some pretty solid coyote populations. So my question in all of this, are entire species classified as cyanthropes, or is it individuals within a species that's classified as cyanthropes?
Ah, my young Padawan, fast you learn, but faster you forget.
You should have did that in a Yoda voice. But what exactly did I forget?
Well, when we first introduced the concept of cyanthropes last week, the definition that we used to talk about them was individuals within a species adapting to urban environments, while their wild cousins remain, well, wild.
Ah, so it is an individual thing.
Yeah, for the most part. Now, there are some species that have really adapted well to man, and they pretty much can't live without us, such as, you know, the old world rats and, you know, a few of those insect species, like you said, like lice or silverfish.
Oh, I like silverfish, actually. they're a lot less freaky than those big, what are they, house centipedes with all those giant long legs. Silverfish don't bother me that much. Anyway, just speaking of silverfish, you only see them in your sink or your bathtub. I can't tell you the last time I was hiking and I had a silverfish run across the trail.
Okay, wise guy. So what else do you want to talk about regarding urban wildlife?
All right. Well, we started this podcast talking about animals that have adapted to living in close proximity with humans. That cyanthrope word that we keep throwing out there. One of the first things that popped into my mind was the shock gobbles from the turkeys, and I went and explained all that. Now, I know I initially said that half jokingly about those gobbles, but now I'm not joking. So let's talk about negative. We've been talking about how animals have adapted and benefit from living in an urban environment. So let's talk about the negative aspects of living around humans. Now, you mentioned some of them from the paper that we're referencing. For example, animal densities are often much higher in these artificial human environments.
Yeah, and unfortunately, many people think the more the merrier, and that's not always the case. You know, lots of people, they love seeing lots of animals, but you have to remember it's still wildlife, and wildlife is kind of like NASA. You know, they need their space. So in fact, space is actually one of the basic needs for animals that people often forget about.
Yeah. And the thing is, I totally get that. I mentioned the whole brother thing, but I imagine most people enjoy living in a house with their immediate family, with their spouse and their kids. But now imagine living in that same house with all your brothers and sisters and all your aunts and uncles, and even with the neighbors down the road, and you're all living in that same house with you. It would not be long before you couldn't stand it anymore.
And now you know exactly why there's a higher incidence of intraspecific aggression, you know, among animals that are living in and around these human environments. It's a higher density of animals means more infighting. So when you think about it, there's a quality of life issue here, you know, and just so you know what we're talking about, it's mostly behavioral issues, you know, and what interests me more than the behavioral side of things is the morphological. You know, we mentioned the impacts of lights on circadian rhythm. And yes, we have noises that have caused behavioral tweaks with vocalizations. I'm wondering if there's any other morphological changes that have occurred or, you know, maybe are occurring in these cyanthropic species.
Oh, I have no doubt about that. It's literally happening right before our eyes. The problem, though, is the speed of evolution in which these changes occur, it usually can't be detected with our own eyes. It takes generations to occur. Now, I'm mostly speaking about the mammal world. So those changes might not be noticeable to us for literally like thousands and thousands of years. But having said that, I have no doubt, especially that there's changes in some other, what are they called? Not genre, the other categories of animals. For example, insects, the insect world. We actually have documented those changes that those insects have undergone because they are living in an urban environment. Now, remember, an insect's lifespan is generally much shorter, so they can evolve faster. And just curious, did you get a chance to read that fun little paper I sent you just yesterday regarding the bed bugs?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and we can often see adaptations with fish and small bird species too, because they also, you know, have shorter lifespans. But I didn't want really, I mean, you sent it to me, I read it. I didn't want to consider insects though, because the thought of bed bugs literally makes my skin crawl.
But notice I sent it to you like at 10 o'clock last night, knowing you were just tucking yourself into bed.
With a friendship like this, it makes me wonder. But, you know, it talked about how bed bugs have adapted to the chemicals that we use to control them, namely pyrethrins and pyrethroids. So these two chemicals they're pretty much one and the same. You know, one is simply a synthetic version of the natural chemical, which is found in chrysanthemum plants. So as you can imagine, plants, they're so cool. They have naturally developed defenses against lots of things, but specifically against insects. It is just unbelievably, beautifully complicated how all of these chemicals work. But pyrethrins and pyrethroids, they muck up the nervous system by binding to sodium pores and locking those into an open position. So that allows the sodium to just pour into the cell continuously, causing the nerve to fire repeatedly and eventually leading to paralysis. Anyway, so for decades, humans have used these chemicals to control bed bugs in our environment, and those bugs have now mutated. So the cells are no longer affected by that chemical.
Yeah. And now you see why I sent you that article.
To make me lose sleep. No, yeah, it makes perfect sense now. So it's a perfect example of how species have adapted and have changed morphologically to the human environment. And I can see why, you know, you have no doubt other species are doing the same thing. It's just obviously it's going to take longer time for us to really see those morphological adaptations.
So who's the young Padawan now?
I'm still going to say you, but I am proud of you for doing so much homework on this. You know, I love when you learn new things almost as much as I love when I learn new things. So that was a decent example, though, of a cyanthropic species adapting to an artificial environment. So I applaud you. I admit I am a little impatient when it comes to the mammalian mutations.
Yeah, don't worry. If your thinking is anywhere near like mine, I think foxes will develop thermal imaging eyesight before we know it.
Really?
Yeah, no. But it is interesting to think about how some of these animals or mammals, birds, whatever, how they can evolve to better adapt to that urban lifestyle. And as I'm sitting here, it made me laugh because as I said that, I had an image of an armadillo.
Of an armadillo.
Yeah, well, I mentioned about how mammals need to adapt to the urban lifestyle. You know what an armadillo is. What do you find on the road dead all the time in places where they live? You find armadillos there. One of the armadillo's adaptation, and this is a natural adaptation from the last however many hundreds of thousands of years. What do they do when they get scared?
They go pill bug. They roll up.
Okay, what's the other thing they do? Because that's not the answer I was looking for.
Okay, then what? Tell me, what answer are you looking for, sir?
it's so interesting because if you scare them or surprise them, they jump straight up in the air. They just hop straight up in the air. So As you can imagine, an armadillo is rather small, and if you're driving your car down the road and there's one in the middle of the road, your car would probably ride right over it, no harm done. But what happens? The armadillo turns around, sees a car barreling it, and they jump up there. And that's why they get smacked all the time, because they're jumping up into the cars. So that is the first adaptation I'm going to demand the mammals make, is they got to talk to their armadillo buddies and say, don't stop jumping when you see those two bright lights, would you?
Okay, so I think we're getting pretty far off topic now, which is usually a sign that we covered as much as we probably should. What do you say we start wrapping this puppy up?
I say the puppy might not like that idea too much.
Touche, Mr. Gigglebus over there.
Okay, I'm better.
Well, folks, it has been a treat talking to you about these animals that live amongst us, you know, these cyanthropic animals that we often know and love, minus the lice and the bed bugs and the silverfish, of course. We hope you've learned a few things, as well as maybe sparked an interest to investigate more on your own. So on that, Daryl, do you have any shout outs for today?
Nothing regarding our podcast, but I'm going to give a shout out to lots of our interested bear loving folks out there. I was going here, didn't you?
I knew that you couldn't make it a full episode without bringing a bear into it.
Well, I gave a bear webinar yesterday. We had 170 people sign up for that webinar. And obviously bears are in the limelight. It's been a really rough year with incidences with bears and humans kind of getting in fights. So anyway, unfortunately, there's a lot of people on edge right now about what they should do in bear country. And so I gave a webinar yesterday about understanding bears and vocalizations and body posturing. And to have 170 people sign up for that, I was just blown away. So big shout out to all the people out there that are wanting to learn more about bears. So do you have any shout outs you want to give?
You know, well, if you're going to bring bear incidents into it, even though we didn't talk about bears today, I feel a strong urge to give a shout out to my wildlife human attack response training crew for our continued and ongoing work in helping state, federal, and provincial wildlife agencies when they have to deal with things like this.
They're getting a workout this year.
Yes, they are. And we've had more requests than ever to have more training. So,
okay. That's actually a great shout out. In fact, that came up on the webinar yesterday. There was a number of questions, especially relating to this last Colorado incident. And I reminded everyone just to keep not just the victim's family in their thoughts and prayers, but all the first responders, because they really do have a difficult situation to deal with. So, yeah. All right. With that, folks, let me start wrapping this up and remind everyone just how much we absolutely truly appreciate you, and how much we truly appreciate you telling all of your friends and family about us. And as Stephanie says, even your enemies about us, and really inviting them to follow along with this Wildlife for You podcast. And to do that, all you have to do is go to your favorite podcast platform and follow the Wildlife for You podcast. And usually I say that wrong and Stephanie corrects me, but how'd I do?
You did good.
Oh, okay. Anyway, if you like our podcast, you can also visit us on the interwebs. We do have a website that Stephanie designed at www.wildlifeforyou.com, all spelled out, no spaces. But the best place to follow along with us is my favorite place, which is the Book of Faces, also known as Facebook. Again, just follow Wildlife for You and like our page.
Yep. So thanks again for joining us. And remember, folks, that when it comes to wildlife, honestly and truly, your knowledge often does mean their existence. Night, folks. Did you have to mention bed bugs?
You're just lucky I didn't mention those other bugs.
What other bugs? You mean like German cockroaches?
No, trust me, you don't want to know.